Welcome back, everybody, to the Recovering Investment Banker podcast. I'm your host, Eric, the one who doesn't know much about this stuff. And with me, as always, the actual recovering investment banker, Chris Kaufman. Thank you for being here, Chris.
It's great to be here, Eric. Thank you.
This is our sixth episode, and I'm having fun doing this. I've learned a lot. And if we go back, we've talked about what a market is and the differences between money and capital. And we talked about the core functions of what an investment banker actually does, which, if I can summarize, is to convert non-capital or close to capital assets into actual financial capital products, such as funds, etc. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's a good summary. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how they do that is they take something and they do the underwriting process, which is what we talked about in episode 5. But today we've got a special guest, one of your friends from the investment banking world. And I was hoping you can introduce him because he was listening to the podcast and he has volunteered to be a part of this episode.
Yeah, well, thank you, Eric. Actually, I'm delighted that after I begged and pleaded, Justin volunteered to be part of our podcast on this particular episode. Justin Simpson is a very intelligent, experienced investment banker who I haven't had enough time with over the years, actually, but about 30 years ago, I suppose, we were both young bankers in New York. Justin had just joined Morgan Stanley in the derivatives area, back when derivatives were a super sexy, super hot, new, cutting-edge product, sector of the financial markets. It was a very innovative way to manage risk. And I think it's fair to say, Justin, you got in close to the ground floor. The ISDA swap agreements had just been codified probably a couple of years before that.
Well, you guys are basically speaking Portuguese to me.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Derivatives, ISDA, all that stuff. But, you know, we may do future episodes on that, but I'll let you get back to it.
Okay. So very briefly, you know, it's fair to say that Justin got in on the ground floor of a very glamorous, sexy, and very structurally important part of the financial world at the time. And by the way, Eric, I know you want to keep this moving, but I would love to understand how Justin's decades of experience in derivatives and synthetic securities gives him context for talking about blockchain, Bitcoin. But Eric, I know you want to go somewhere else with this, so we're not going to talk about that.
We'll get there eventually.
I would love to talk to Justin about that, but that's not what we're going to do today. The point is, I went to Latin America for a few years and then Australia, and basically, I kind of have no idea about all the amazing things Justin's done. Can't do justice to them. And Justin, you're just going to have to speak for yourself.
So welcome to the show, Justin Simpson.
Thank you, Eric, and thanks, Chris. Just to give a quick sentence, I spent 20 years at Morgan Stanley. The first 10, I was a financial engineer, effectively creating risk management solutions for investing clients, for issuing clients. And then 5 years, I ran a portion of the research world. I was head of global economics and global strategy for interest rates, currencies, derivatives. The last 5 years, I switched poacher turned gamekeeper, I think, and went to the investment management side, where I built up what was called the Liquid Alternatives Program. So a series of funds in equities, currencies, fixed income, commodities that were designed in such a way that they would not move in sync with the market, that they would create diversification in a portfolio. And then I left and started my own firm. And then I moved to the United States, folded up that, and like Chris, became a recovering banker.
Ah, well, we are blessed to have you on this show. And today, you and I had a call last week, just getting to know you. And today I want to talk about a little bit about what goes on after the underwriting process. Episode 5, we talked about what the underwriting process is. It's, you know, investment bank comes to an asset, offers, I guess, the winning bid and says, all right, I will pay you X amount of money for this asset. And then they will get sub underwriters and they will try to sell it for more than they bought it for and make money on the spread. Is that a safe summary of what the underwriting process is, Justin?
I think that's accurate. And when you talked on that episode about the sub-underwriters or pension funds, large institutional investors who have the capacity to take on millions and millions, if not tens of millions of that process, you're talking about one sector of the market, one place that the shares go. But the other place is towards retail investors. And retail investors might get exposure to that underwriting through, in some cases, directly buying the shares. The broker comes to them and says, I have some shares in an exciting new venture or company that I think belongs in your portfolio, and they would buy those shares individually. But for most people, their exposure in their pension fund or in their investments is through aggregated pools of equities. And in that case, a fund would buy the shares, a fund on behalf of those retail investors. So instead of me putting $1,000 into IBM, I put $1,000 into a vehicle, a legal vehicle, which invests in a bunch of things, including IBM.
And that vehicle would be called a fund.
That would be called a fund, yes. The most common form of that fund in the United States is called a mutual fund because, as it suggests, it's a bunch of people mutually sharing their exposure to a pool of assets.
So, Justin, what you're saying is that when you do an underwriting with an investment banker, you know, Fidelity or somebody, Vanguard, will buy a $20 or $30 million block, say. And then guys like us, let's say the three of us are all Vanguard retail investors, I'll take 1,800, you know, you'll take 2,200, Eric will take 3,500. And those are little fragments of that $30 million block that Vanguard took as a sub-underwriter. And there's all these little blocks or little ice shavings that are aggregate up to the $30 million block that Vanguard had. So
that's
Eric,
exactly
is that,
right.
Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds clear to me.
Okay.
I think that's exactly right. When a retail investor wants to invest in that story, I'm excited by the next IPO, the next public thing, and I want to invest directly. So my broker calls me or I call my broker and say, I'd like a piece of that. The other intermediary piece is that Vanguard or Fidelity buys that 20 or 30 million shares, doesn't give it to individual investors, puts it into a collective, which is intended to mirror the technology sector, the utility sector, just the S&P 500, just the Dow or the NASDAQ. And that collection is the fund. Is the fund piece that we're talking about, the mutual fund.
Well, I think that's a great place to build this episode around. I want to learn about what funds really are. So you mentioned mutual funds. Of course, I've heard of that. Most people have probably heard of it, maybe didn't understand what it is. What other types of funds are there? And then let's drive in on something that you two have been directly involved with creating. So what other types of funds are out there beyond a mutual fund?
Well, we're talking about equities, and so we should come back to equity funds, which are collections of individual shares. But there are other funds out there like money market funds or bond funds that are investing in different asset classes, commodity funds. Once you come back to that equity sphere, basically collective investments do, let's say, one of three things. The one is that they just track an index. All I want is exposure to the Dow Jones, and therefore I invest in a fund, and all it holds is the components of the Dow Jones in exact proportion to the index. I have a share of that, and whatever performance I get should track closely to the performance of the Dow Jones. The second is a very popular type of fund called an exchange-traded fund.
An ETF.
ETF, exactly. And an ETF follows an index. The index could be something as straightforward as the Dow, but it's evolved to mean any sort of index that I could create, a custom index of Justin's approach to technology investing index. The third type is a fund in which an actual manager or team of managers get together and decide what shares to put into a fund. And that is the most common traditional mutual fund. The struggle going on right now is between ETFs that follow specific indices, which are generally more heuristic, algorithmic. They have technical repeatable processes.
They sound like they're more automated.
Or more automated. And the traditional mutual fund, which is a bunch of guys who've got an interest in a sector or a geography or an asset management strategy, and you're buying a share of their management skill in investing in the fund.
Justin, you know, there's the Vanguards and the Fidelities and these enormous funds, which are fundamentally retail investment vehicles. But there's also example after example, and I'm kind of out of it these days, of guys who started off one of these, you know, these flavors or these, you know, these flavors of funds in a sector. And then it gets very successful. They prove their worth with institutional investors who are extremely demanding and monitoring their performance, and ultimately are quite happy with their being charged versus their investment performance. And then they often will, or at least they used to often, launch a retail fund so that guys like us could get in at $10,000 each or something like that and kind of enjoy the returns that the big boys got to enjoy for the previous years. Does that still happen?
It still happens in exactly that way, but it's also in this current world, and we should chat at some point about how the world of Chris and Justin has evolved into the world of 2021, in which there is a strong movement amongst millennial investors, let's say, to reject exactly that model and go directly into figures that are cult figures who don't necessarily come from the traditional world, haven't necessarily done it the old-fashioned way that you described, but go straight into new world investing. There's a very good example of somebody who's a hybrid called Cathy Wood, and she runs a fund called the ARK Innovation ETF. And it's a multi-billion dollar fund that is subscribed to, although she's not a millennial, but is subscribed to largely by millennials. And her approach to investing is completely orthogonal to the way that we've described it, where you have a system, a thought process, as whether it's a repeatable automated one or a more judgmental approach. And instead, she's focused on story stocks, where she believes there's deep value. She's looking for stocks that Wall Street doesn't yet understand or respect. So by definition, the sorts of stocks that we might find difficult to buy at their current values, if at all. And she's built her entire strategy around that. So names like Tesla, Roku, Coinbase, Zoom, Shopify, Spotify, these are all names that are very much part of that millennial lexicon. And she's taking large bets on small individual names. That's an investing style. It's valid. It's just quite different from the way we used to do it in the past, in which you would actually look for intrinsic value to try and determine which stocks in a particular sector look more or less attractive, to try and understand future cash flows, future growth, the different valuation methodologies that we'd apply to decide whether or not to buy a stock.
Well, it sounds almost like buzz value. Not that, I mean, that's a term I just kind of made up in my head, but it's the latest buzz, right? It's what people are talking about now, whether it's intrinsic or not. If it's popular now, well, there's buzz around it, right? Is that kind of what you're getting at?
It is what I'm getting at. And, you know, the fantastic example of this is the recent Reddit Wall Street Bets group, who have taken to picking stocks and ramping them in particular to try and make money. But if it hurts some big institutional investors, that's an added bonus or benefit for them as well.
Well, that's a fascinating story. I know you're getting at the GameStop thing, and Chris and I have talked quite a bit about the GameStop thing, and I think if we could keep it brief, we could at least do a very quick overview of what the hell happened with the GameStop stock. I'll let you guys go. Chris, if you want to take on this first and then let Justin sort of fill in the gaps.
You know,
all I know is it was fun to watch.
Yeah, it was a dramatic episode. But, you know, what I would like to do actually is discuss GameStop in the context of Justin's career, basically finding ways to hedge positions, right? I mean, that was kind of what you were. You're a financial engineer. Your clients would come, they had a risk profile, and you would engineer a solution to calibrate that risk, neutralize the risk, change it into a different risk. And, you know, GameStop is kind of an interesting example of just risk blowing out in a way that nobody anticipated. And how would you have intervened on behalf of a hedge fund caught in this vice? What could you have done, for example, to kind of quickly, you know, unwind that position and save them a few hundred million bucks?
Sadly, very little, Chris.
Oh, really?
The point was that was so extreme. So most models, whether they're for options or other risk control methodologies, have to assume some sort of underlying range of movement. So let's just say, hypothetically, I assume that a stock price has a normal distribution. Therefore, it has some sort of discernible pattern of movement that includes volatility, how much it moves each day or each week. It includes some sort of mean, where it is, where the price is. It includes some sort of assumed future value. If you look at GameStop pre-Wall Street Bets, it was a very unappealing stock by most assessments. It was potentially heading down to zero. Hence the shorts, the Wall Street shorts against it. But if you looked at it by any of its fundamental valuations, how much cash flow it's generating, how much any of the sort of traditional methodologies, how many dividends it's paying, what its dividend growth profile is, all of these competing methodologies that used to be used to assess what the value of a share is, you would come out with a very unattractive number. And therefore, you'd build your hedging strategy around that.
Now, what does hedging mean?
So what Chris is talking about might be buying options that will create value such that when your share goes down, the option value goes up and the two values offset each other. It might create a pattern in which as a share goes down by a certain amount, you sell some, so you reduce your risk gradually. But any of those methodologies have to assume that you have some understanding of the basic price movement. And what Wall Street Bets did was blow that up so that no model of price could accurately capture that. And therefore, if you were the hedge fund holding the short position when it was up 30, 40, 60, 100%, there wasn't very much you could do other than lose quite a bit of money if you weren't able to trade out, which, as you know, at one point trading ceased, and so you were kind of
and
left
those
holding
people,
the bag.
Those people holding those shares were refusing to sell,
so
at huge gains.
Should we maybe just go, like, you know, Justin is so experienced in this area, maybe to discuss hedges. I can remember how we were taught the concept of a hedge. So basically, you're a farmer with a field full of corn. Now, your problem is that you have to wait for the corn to mature before you can sell the corn. So you're exposed to a falling corn prices, and you have no control over that. So, and this probably goes back to literally, you know, Justin, you're the expert on this. These are corn futures. This is one of the earliest hedges, if you will, that were invented. Someone would come to you and say, okay, Farmer Knight, I'll buy right now your field full of corn at such and such a price. And you
at
would agree to
price.
That. Whatever that. Well, as Justin's saying, it's complex because there's a whole price curve. There's a current price, there's future prices and everything else. But at a price, whatever that price is, and you would then have hedged your risk. Now, if the price went up, neighbor next door would get more for his corn because he didn't sell to Justin. But if the price went down, you're done. You're good. You've committed to your price, and you're going to get it done. So that's a classic hedge. But here's where
a hedge meaning it's
a risk offset. It's an offset of risk. But here's the problem, and this goes down the wormhole into the Alice in Wonderland world in which Justin thrived, because it's not that you need experts to help you with this. So let's say, for example, here's the problem. You now have a contract to sell your field full of corn at whatever price you agree. You think you're fine. What happens if a hailstorm comes through and you have no corn? You're now hosed. You still have to deliver that field full of corn at that price, but you no longer have any corn. You have to go out and buy some to deliver to Justin. Now, if the price has gone down, you actually make a windfall profit because you're going to buy cheaper corn and give it to Justin, who's already committed the price. But if all that hail took out a lot of the supply of corn, the price is actually going to go up. So to avoid bankruptcy, you're going to have to go out and buy corn at a higher price to deliver it to Justin, who, as smart Wall Street investment bankers often do, makes money on the trade. So that's why, and this is ultra simple. The kind of stuff that Justin did is far more complex, but it shows you how, you know, the best intentions in the world can result in very nasty, scary losses.
Chris has actually introduced quite an interesting concept. Your farmer who is selling corn that he doesn't have, effectively, in his case, it's because the corn was destroyed by a hailstorm. But the farmer selling corn that he doesn't have could easily be a farmer who doesn't grow the corn. He just sells it in the future, knowing that he's going to have to buy it and deliver it. That's called short selling. And that's what a very popular activity in the financial markets looks exactly like. I think that the price of GameStop at 160 is too high. I don't have any GameStop, so I don't take a profit on what I've already have, but I sell it. What it means is I've effectively committed to deliver X shares of GameStop at some future date. When that day arrives, if I'm right and 160 was too high and it's down to 30, I'm quids in. I buy it at 30, deliver it at 160, and there's my profit from short selling. If, on the other hand, I'm wrong because Wall Street Bets decides that it's going to hodl, it's at 180 or 250, I have to go and buy it anyway and deliver it at 160.
And I lose a lot of money.
Yes. Now,
and that's what happened.
In the case of that particular example, the shorts were happening very, very, very far away from the ultimate price to which the Wall Street Bets traders drove GameStop. And so the losses were in the billions,
which, as
I say, allowed them to make some money, but also allowed them to have the joy of sticking it to Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was fun to watch, even though I did not participate in it. So let's get back. That was a nice little segue. But the core of this episode, I think, while we have you here, Justin, is we talked about funds. You mentioned hedge funds, mutual fund, ETF. How do these things get created? I mean, what do they don't just come out of thin air. I presume investment bankers like you guys actually conceive these ideas and create them from the ground up. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. And there's two parts to that creation. The one is the legal framework under which we do that. So if something is going to be put into the hands of retail investors, the government, relevant authorities, have set up a framework such that those retail investors have protections. What we say is going to happen is going to happen. We're not going to as easily defraud those investors. So under that legal structure, and exactly, the financial lawyers would go ahead and create something. Let's say a mutual fund. They would file all the papers. Those papers would be reviewed and approved by the security authorities. And then they would have the ability to say, okay, I have a fund that's regulated and safe enough for mom and pop money. Or I have a slightly less neat package of a hedge fund that's based in the Cayman Islands, and therefore mom and pop can't invest in it, but only big money investors, accredited investors, can invest in it, etc. So the level of protection is determined by the size or sophistication of the investor who's going to invest in that.
Which means that people like me, who are not big money investors, but I invest in the hundreds and the thousands of dollars at a time, I'm a retail investor, right? I invest through Vanguard. And to some degree through Robinhood, mainly just because it's fun for small little things. But everything I'm investing in is basically, sounds like it's heavily regulated and there's a lot of protections in it for me. Is that what you're saying?
This is the whole thing. I mean, you have to be so careful, because a so-called low-risk retail investment vehicle, you could still lose 90% of your investment on.
Right. I'm not saying it's low risk. I'm saying it's low risk of fraud.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
The market could tank, but at least I'm not getting scammed. That's
right.
What I'm getting at.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. I would refer to that as regulatory risk, let's say, in a low regulatory risk environment. If I came along to you separately and said, oh, Eric, I've got this great deal, give me some money and trust me, that'd be one end of the regulatory risk spectrum.
Yeah, but basically no
everything
regulation.
In between. And the other end is, I've got this thing that I have to report daily prices. The SEC is watching me. If I make a mistake, I'm going to go to jail. That sort of low regulatory risk. That's completely separate, as Chris is saying, from the investment thesis. So coming back to your point, now I've got this vehicle I've created. Let's say it's a mutual fund regulated by the SEC. Mm-hmm. The question is, what am I going to do inside that fund? And in this case, I might have a thesis myself. I think, like Kathy Wood, technology stocks that are not understood well enough by Wall Street are going to explode. I might have a more conventional thesis, like the utility sector is underloved and yet it throws off quite high dividends. Any number of theses, I have to first persuade people to put money into that thesis. So now I have my fund, let's call it a Morgan Stanley fund for argument's sake, since that's where I was. I go to get to retail investors through a sales force, through a marketing program, and I tell my story. Mm-hmm. Justin's infrastructure fund is a good way for a retail investor to get exposure to the wall of money that's coming towards infrastructure with the government's new infrastructure bill. I've discovered, or at least I think I have, a process that's going to allow retail investors who can't buy airports or create toll roads to benefit from that infrastructure boom. And that's what I'm arguing I'm going to put into this fund that I've created. The marketing guys, like that story or not, they go to the brokers who like that story or not, who go to their clients. Now Eric gets a call from his broker at Fidelity saying, Eric, there's this interesting thing coming up. You've seen the infrastructure wall of money that the government is talking about, repairing roads and ports and railways. I've heard about this fund that is going to take advantage of that. Are you interested? You say, no, sounds like a good deal. I hear a little bit about it. You don't need to really get into the weeds. You need to satisfy yourself enough that it makes sense, that it's being done by a credible institution with a credible story to tell. You ask your broker, is this going to be expensive? And he says, well, you know, there's a manager doing it and he's got judgment and experience, so it's going to be a bit more expensive than just investing in an ETF, which is matching an index. You're comfortable or not with that decision. It's a mutual fund, so it has expenses because of all of this regulatory reporting that we're talking about. So you're going to pay.
I'm going to pay more fees because it's actively managed by experts.
Yes, exactly. And if you're comfortable with that, you say, okay, I'll put in my $1,000. That's going on at scale around the country through different institutions, different brokers. and that money is coming in.
Well, don't you think this is kind of getting the cart before the horse? At least that's kind of, maybe I'm missing something here, but we just went from the conception of the idea, but I don't know how the sausage was actually made. Now you're already talking about how we take it to market, but don't we have to actually pick the funds or pick the stocks that go into this?
Well,
sausage?
That's the whole point. You're actually, well, and of course, Justin can add additional color around this, but by the way, the most sophisticated investors in the world back, and ironically, Justin's vignette about how this could be, you could be defrauded. Justin says, comes to you and says, want to invest.
Trust me.
Actually, that's how the big end of town works. At the largest institutional investors in the world, effectively, Justin says, trust me. And they go, yeah, we do trust you. We've heard you're amazing. And we're so excited to be able to get a piece of the action. Here's $50 million. And by the way that normally works, Eric, is exactly what you're describing. Justin will, in a private equity fund, for example, available only to institutional investors and sophisticated investors, Justin will take your money for 7 years or even 10 years. And he starts out with $1 billion or $3 billion, or maybe it's $500 million. He's got the money. And basically he says in 7 years or 10 years, I'm going to give you back your money. Plus probably I'm shooting for a 20 or 30% IRR.
Well, hold on. IR? What? Hold on. What's IR?
Oh, internal rate of return, which is a, it's actually kind of voodoo for reasons that actually, Justin, I'd love to know how your theological take on IRR is. But basically, because it assumes a reinvestment rate, there's no real way of ever knowing what the IRR is until it's over. But it's, let's just call it a standard benchmark. Roughly, it means your investment return on the capital you've committed.
So let me see if I'm getting this straight, Chris. He doesn't actually own anything in this mutual fund yet. So he goes to the big investor and say, hey, I got an idea. Can you float me this money on a term? Let's say it's five,
yeah,
6, 7 years while I build this fund. And
correct,
I'm guaranteeing you will get your money back.
The way the most sophisticated investors in the world work is they find Justin Simpson who says, trust me. And they do trust him.
But Eric, you said at the end, and I'm guaranteeing that you'll get your money back. That's not part of it at all. The trust me is that I won't get it wrong. And there's a fantastic example in a book that's just been released and it's been written up in a number of magazines of the company WeWork, where the trust me turned into a company that was losing about, just before it crashed, was losing about $1.5 billion a year and at an accelerating pace of loss. And yet the trust me, the CEO of that company, had got a lot of sophisticated investors on board, and the valuation just before things went south was $47 billion. So if that isn't the extreme of trust me, I don't know what is. And that's very recent. And it's an amazing story of exactly what Chris is talking about.
Well, don't you think? I mean, some of that's COVID related because people stopped working in offices, but that's a separate issue. I mean, that's a force majeure, like we had talked about in a previous episode, of force majeure, of some act of God. COVID happens, people can't go to the office.
Well, you know, that's true, Eric. But as a matter of interest, Justin, are you following Uber, for example? I mean, are they cash flow positive yet, or are they still cash flow negative? I don't want to put you on the spot. I just don't know. It'd be interesting because, Eric, here's the point. And without pointing fingers at anybody, that funds manager that Justin was referring to, Kathy Wood or whatever her name is, I would assume a lot of those companies have a similar profile, i.e. substantial negative cash flow and very large multi-billion dollar valuations. And she said, trust me, to investors. And apparently she's very successful. A lot of people trust her. The management has basically said, trust me, to her. And the whole premise is that somebody knows what they're doing. And this is all going to work out. So we get back into the old world, Justin and I know, which is you basically value a company on its cash flows because they actually do have cash flows and you've got good reason to think that they're going to grow.
This is a different world. There isn't a right or wrong. In fact, some of the millennials would say we are wrong because look at the value of a Tesla or an Amazon when it was losing money versus today. And therefore your traditional models are keeping you out of one of the most exciting phases of the economy. So they may have a point there, but what we would do in our world is to say this company is throwing off a certain amount of cash. Let's value it by present valuing all of those future cash flows. with some growth. This company is paying out dividends, and so I'm going to have a dividend discount model. I'm just going to think about how much, I don't really care about the value of the enterprise, I'm going to think about how much it's going to pay me over the years. This company has a patent that it's allowing it to do something that others can't compete with. That's attractive because it's going to throw off cash. This company is in a sector that's become unattractive for societal reasons, like a tobacco company, so it's actually making a lot of money. So whatever those theses of valuation are, there's some grounding, some modeling, some analysis, some forecasting, imprecise, and sometimes imprecise by heuristic algorithm, sometimes imprecise by human judgment, but either way, at least grounded in reality. And it's very hard to put a number on what is the value of WeWork when it's positioned as a tech company with tech growth multiples, etc. But in actual fact, it's a real estate play, which conventional investors think of as a much more boring and predictable sector of the economy.
So let me direct this, because I kind of feel like we could keep talking about this in that direction for a while. I want to redirect our focus here. The question is still, when do you select and how do you select the meat that goes in that sausage? How do you select the stuff that you invest in that gets bundled together in your fund?
So let's take infrastructure as an example. I would take a look at that. I'd do this analysis before I went to market, to be clear, Eric. I was jumping straight over the "and then stuff happens" bit.
But the we did that in the last episode too. And Chris made the analogy of, hey, we went on the first date and here's a baby.
Okay, so let's be in that rather that rather blue zone for a minute. A research team, the portfolio management team, sits down and says, okay, what is infrastructure? Let's try and categorize it. And then there's different ways. So let's try and write them down, shape up what are the fields of infrastructure. So, for example, looking at transportation, you might think about airports, railroads, toll roads, ports.
Sewer systems. That's what I think of, big concrete projects, bridges, roads.
So as I say, in the transportation field is one, the commodity field, what produces or transports commodities, processes commodities, that would be oil, water, that sort of stuff. There's data infrastructure. You see, as you drive up and down the highway, these cell phone towers, they aren't necessarily put up and owned by T-Mobile or Sprint. They're put up and owned by companies who lease them or lease the use of them. So I create, again, a list of these companies, and then I develop a metric. And my metric could be as simple as, I'll sit at the desk with my other portfolio managers and we'll pick whether we want to be 10% water, 20% road, or we'll try to put a size on them, which are the largest and represent our portfolio by having, roughly speaking, a proportion that's equivalent to the size. How big is water relative to data centers? How big is the port infrastructure relative to toll roads? I might choose to do that with models that use these traditional cash flow methodologies that we were talking about. How much cash is being thrown off by the Port of Oakland, the Port of Los Angeles, and over the next few years, how might that grow and how might I value that? So I'll come up with a valuation methodology that might be the traditional one that we talked about, free cash flow analysis, dividend flow analysis, etc. Or it might be more judgmental. I might say I believe that as we come out of the pandemic, trade with China is going to resume in a particular way, and therefore the ports that benefit from China trade might be more helped than some other, and therefore I'm going to overweight my portfolio towards Brookfield's because they have the Pacific Rim facing ports versus another port company. So all of those methodologies come together. I have to be able to structure that message in a way that's coherent. I have to be able to turn it into a portfolio of 20 or 200 shares and have some methodology for how I allocate between those shares. I have to have at least some conception of how they correlate to each other. So if does data center growth have any relation to water treatment? Probably not, which is probably a good thing because I can have both of those sectors represented if something happens in one.
And then it sounds to me like you're actively going to be rebalancing as time goes on.
Absolutely. And that is part of why I can ask for a fee, in this case for active management, relative to just saying, let's create an ETF based on the infrastructure index.
All right, so I'm going to try to summarize what you said. You've got a lot of, as I've learned in previous episodes, a lot of valuation skills as an investment banker, and you have a team running computer models, cash flow analysis, all sorts of stuff on all these companies, and then you make decisions based on the best information you have on how to actually fill the sausage, right? I mean, you're just choosing different stuff to pack in there at different percentages based on what you decide, and then you rebalance over time to optimize that. Do I have that correct?
Exactly. And okay. One of the things that's interesting, just coming back to the old world rather than the new, is that for all of the many years that active managers charged fees for theoretically doing a better job, it became clear through the data that, in fact, all they were doing was really delivering mostly index performance. A few notable exceptions, of course, a few really heroic performance individuals.
But it's very rare.
But more often than not, those active managers were really charging a high fee to deliver something like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, the Russell 2000. And therefore, financial engineers, people like me said, well, why don't we just create really cheap alternatives that don't pretend to make those active selections, that don't use their personal judgment, that just use a computer algorithm
to automate it.
Automate it and to replicate the index. And of course, once you do that, it costs a lot less. You can offer for lower fees. Lower fees over 15 years if you're paying 2% a year to have your fund managed versus 20 basis points a year. It's effectively getting 1.8% of cumulative return, which over 20 years is a monstrous amount.
So what's a basis point?
Oh, good point. Yep.
I beg your pardon.
Wait, what is a basis? You got to remember, this is not for me. I happen to know what it is, but the audience might not.
It's 0.01%.
Oh, wow.
And so in this world, 1% sounds like a little in the real world, but in fund management, if I can charge you 1% of a very big number every year versus charging you 0.1% or 10 basis points a year, the cumulative impact is enormous.
Yeah, there was a famous, you remember, this is probably about the time you were born, right? Linda Evangelista, you know, said something. She was this model from like the 80s or something. She at the time famously said, I don't get out of bed for anything less than $10,000 a day. So to flip that around, I would get out of bed for 8 basis points.
Well, you're also dealing with billions and billions. So let's kind of direct this into two directions. I'm going to go to Chris first. So first of all, thank you for that, Justin. Both of you have actually created funds. And in conversations before recording this, Chris, you had created a fund, and you don't need to say company names. You can keep it anonymous, however you're comfortable with. You created a fund that was not available to retail investors, correct?
Correct.
You probably several.
Yeah.
Give me an example of what you did, sharing what you can share for the audience, how you went about it, and who it actually was available to.
Well, okay. Basically, the investment world is full of different kinds of institutional investors. I mean, there's insurance companies, there's banks, there's, you know, the proprietary owned funds of huge investment banks like Morgan Stanley, and they have to commit capital, and so they're restlessly looking for places that they can commit capital safely and get a good return. To give you an idea of the scale of this and why there's room for a lot of people. I remember talking to a client in Australia who was an infrastructure CEO of an infrastructure company, and we took him to market, and i.e. there's going to be an underwriting, and I think it was, I can't remember anymore, let's just say it was $300 or $400 million. It was not a super huge deal, but it wasn't a small deal. And so we had all these institutional investors, mostly from the United States, on the line, and they were kind of introducing themselves, and I forget anyway. Basically, he was told that in this auditorium and on the phone from Chicago and LA and Seattle and Dallas and Atlanta and wherever, Boston, of course, were a bunch of other people. There were 60 or 70 funds managers in the room. And later, this guy's name is Jim, said, so how much can they speak for? How much could they possibly invest? And the answer was, you know, roughly $20 million, basically. And it was like, they have $20 million a year to invest. It's like, no, it's $20 million a month in this type of security in this particular sector. And there are like 70 of those guys on the phone. So that just gives you an idea of what the scale of this thing is. And they need people like Justin and me and a lot of other people to find investment opportunities for them. Now, what's interesting is, in fact, the data is showing that actually Mr. Market is smarter than anybody. And what you really need to do is find highly technical, very cost-efficient ways to mirror parts of Mr. Market. But that's today. In the old days, it was still much less efficient. And, you know, my fund is basically about finding, this is going back to Eric, some of our conversations before, near capital assets that were going to become financial capital assets. And in fact, not through an investment banker, but me, I was actually going to buy this privately held asset and own it in my fund. And that's how it actually became financial capital.
Got it. And then other people would invest in your fund.
Yeah. And so, for example, Justin's, well, not other people, institutional investors, but Justin's example before about, we know there's this multi-trillion-dollar government, you know, infrastructure bill coming through. All this cash is going to flow into infrastructure. You know, so Justin could be doing the same thing. He could say, look, I've been in this business for 30 years. I know the guys who build the highways, who build the data centers, who build the ports. And I'm going to find new highways that or you know, bridges that are being built or repaired. The guys are going to, and I'm going to get in. I'm going to own those, a piece of those infrastructure assets privately, you know, as a private investor. It's not going to be publicly listed. However, you can have access to those assets through my fund.
My fund.
Correct. Yeah.
Got it. And now, Justin, how about you? What's an example of a fund that you created, whether it went to private investors or retail investors?
So I think one example would be a currency fund that I created. And if you think about the world of currencies, you can, as a retail investor, buy and sell different currencies. But it's generally quite expensive, and generally you do it because you're going on holiday somewhere, or maybe you're buying a property overseas. So it's not really well understood as an investment mechanism, but it's the largest market in the world by far. Probably $5 trillion a day is traded in currencies. It's becoming easier now for retail investors to trade currencies. There are more platforms which that happened, but that wasn't the case a number of years ago. And based on the work that I had done, my team had done when I was running a portion of the research world at Morgan Stanley, we had come up with ways to try and understand why currencies move. They move because of macroeconomics. They move because of valuation differences between countries. They move because there's a price movement that academically has shown that if it goes up 3 days in a row, there's a higher probability of it going up on day four. So thinking about just the technically following the price, etc. And so bringing all of those different methodologies together into a fund created the opportunity to earn a return, an attractive financial return, but that importantly one that didn't behave like the equity markets. Because if you invest in one fund that behaves mostly like the S&P 500, and you invest in a second fund that behaves mostly like the S&P 500, and then you diversify by investing in a third fund that behaves mostly like the Dow Jones, if there's a market crash, guess what happens? All three of your funds crash, right? Whereas if you invest in one that tracks the S&P broadly, one that tracks global equities, let's say, and one that tracks currencies, it's not necessarily the case that if one goes down, the other goes down. In fact, it might be the case that one might go up in response.
And that would be hedging.
And that would be uncorrelated investing. So sort of hedging, yeah. Not precise hedging, but in a way, yes.
But either way, it's considered diversification.
Diversification, exactly.
But would you, gentlemen, mind if I make a quick, sort of selfish little advertising editorial here? So at the beginning of Crisis Deluxe, when Dusty gets the call about having to go to Hong Kong, he's in Buenos Aires, he's in Argentina. Remember one of the first things he says, all he really knows about, he's busy closing a transaction. He couldn't care less what's happening in Asia at that moment. But he has noticed that they're dumping Argentine stocks. He says something like, every time there's a problem anywhere in the world, traders start dumping Argentine stocks. Just pisses me off. Yeah. Because it's making his deal harder. And actually, the Asian financial crisis at the moment has nothing to do with Argentina. They're selling wheat and meat to Europe. But as Justin's saying, actually, there's all kinds of what you think are uncorrelated risks and you buy into all these different financial products, these different funds, and then doomsday comes, and guess what? They all tank. And it isn't even logical. And the very opening pages of Crisis Deluxe, Dusty's just pissed off about it because it doesn't make any sense. But it is what it is.
It's an interesting point, Chris, and you write it very well, actually, in the book, and I lived through it, so I can say that with conviction. One of the practical reasons why that happens is think about a global emerging markets equity fund in the traditional sense, not one quantitatively driven by done by a human. It's trying to cover...
Justin, are you saying that investment bankers are humans? Are you going on record?
I'd like to rethink that one. But you've got a small team, two or three people, trying to cover 30 or 40 countries. They've got a limited pool of resources, a limited pool of information. They're doing their best, so perhaps they've got some on-the-ground resources that they can turn to. But to Chris's point, there's a big order that comes to sell a portion of Asia. Where are they going to get the money? Maybe selling Argentina. Or there's an activity in one part of the world that they are worried is going to spread. Perhaps an Asian crisis will lead ultimately to a South American crisis because Asian trade and the constriction of the Asian economies might. So there might be a legitimate economic reason, but there might also just be a practical reason, which is I have to get the money from somewhere. Right. And so those sorts of correlations are a combination of macroeconomic and practical, but it's important to understand that they exist.
Do you think that this could be tied into what they call the chaos theory, where a butterfly flaps its wings in Japan and there's a tsunami or a big wave that hits California?
It's just the practical reality. It's actually related to liquidity. Justin's made a great point. And in fact, later in that book, if you remember, he has to sell bonds that can still have a market because the investment bank is now stuck with what we used to call toxic waste. No one's going to take it. So as Justin says, actually the good boys get hammered and their prices fall because they're the only way that the investment bank can raise cash to meet their obligations. So if it's bad enough, and by the way, this was a huge feature of 2008, the global financial crisis, some of the very best companies and the best bonds dropped in price dramatically because they were being dumped because the institutions, the investment banks, were so desperate to raise cash to pay off their obligations. So in a scenario like that...
To pay off the shorts, right?
All kinds of... It's very complex. But essentially, it's not just the toxic waste that gets punished in a market disaster like that. The best companies in the world get punished. And they look like there's something wrong with them, but there isn't. They're just... The owners have got to sell those securities to raise cash to meet their obligations.
So let me see if I can summarize all this. And Justin, I would love to have you on in a future episode as well. I feel like there are
absolutely. I just wish
topics.
We could be drinking a good glass of red wine. That's the one problem with these podcasts.
You investment banker types are drinking red wine. Most of our audience is probably like, wine? Let's have a beer.
We like beer too, actually.
Okay. All right. That's good. So basically, investment bankers can create new financial products that eventually someone like me can buy through a brokerage house, either Vanguard, Fidelity, or I guess Merrill Lynch might be one, or any Robinhood, hell. And you put these things together. Now, these are actively managed, but the index ones are automated. So let's talk about an actively managed mutual fund. You go through your analysis of all sorts of cash flows and company size, whatever you think is important. And you go to these big investors and say, hey, trust me, I have an idea. And they say, you know what, Justin, we like you. You have a good track record. Yes, we'll loan you whatever this kind of
invest
is.
In you. Invest in
Sorry,
you.
We'll invest in you. Yeah, right. It's not a loan. We'll invest in you. We believe in you that you can get us such and such returns. Once you have that money secured, you've already done your research, but you begin acquiring these pieces and building your fund, right? You start making the sausage. Do I have the order right so far? Okay.
Yes.
Cool. So I got that. I saw you nodding, but again, we're on a podcast, so thank you for saying something because the audience would be like, whoa, what did he say?
Oh, it's an embarrassing silence. Eric just said something obscene and no one
I know, and all these guys are nodding. Yeah, exactly. Chris gave me the middle finger. It was the weirdest thing. So, no. All right, so they invest. And then once you start acquiring the stuff and you build this fund, then you can take it to retailers. If you want to. I mean, Chris, in Chris's sense, he underwrote companies and put them into his own fund that institutional investors could buy that I never could.
I think that's right. And I think your description is pretty accurate. I think perhaps for a future discussion or you guys should pick up at some point, but I think it's important to talk about something else that's going on. You described a process as it used to exist. It was very hard for retail investors to get direct access other than through a fund or through buying an individual stock on an exchange through their broker. But with the fintech revolution and the rise of distrust in financial institutions, the ability and the will of people to do things without the help of the big investment banks, there's been a big campaign for disintermediation. And one of the acts that was passed during the Obama administration was called the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, or the JOBS Act. And that was fundamental in allowing these retail investors to get in before the IPO. So not only do they not have to invest in the fund, invest directly in the stock, but now it's possible to invest in the company before it's gone public. And there are a number of ways that that can happen, but by and large, there are platforms where you sign up and you don't have to be an accredited investor part of this, or you don't have to have a lot of money or a lot of sophistication or knowledge.
How does one become an accredited investor? What does that mean?
So certain investments are restricted because the regulators believe that they should only be accessible to people with a certain amount of money, a certain amount of income, and a certain amount of experience. And so you and I might say a large, wealthy, experienced investor. All that accredited means is that there's a technical legal framework of the number of dollars that you have to have in the bank. Or
but there's no like certification exam or anything like that?
No.
It's an income and intangible net worth test, as I recall.
And mostly it's done by self-certification. So you tick a box somewhere saying, I meet the requirements to be disclosed as an accredited investor, as opposed to somebody coming in and checking on your bank account.
And what kind of money are we talking about? I mean, I'm assuming there's different levels.
I think it's about, if I remember rightly, it's in the neighborhood of a couple of million of assets other than your house, an income that's in six figures somewhere, the low six figures somewhere per year.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
Something like that. So it's not it's not just for billionaires and the like.
And the idea is that if you're going to put $20,000 into that, you know, you can still feed your kids if you lose it. I mean, that's the idea of it.
So they'll allow you to take on higher risk.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, don't you think that that's some sort of disparity that, well, you're boxing out people from not being able to buy these same investment products that are, you know, at least going to be seen from the outside as an advantage? Why would all these rich people be able to invest in the stuff that I can't get?
Well,
so
you know,
I guess the democratization of finances.
That's exactly what it is. And you know what? The point is there's a good reason why these rules exist. We live in this age of resentment and jealousy and anti-capitalism. And, you know, everyone's assuming the worst motivations for people. But actually, this stuff is extremely risky. And allowing people to get sucked in to this is like, it's an invitation to disaster. It's not an invitation to wealth. It's not ring fencing the best part of the world, you know, for rich white guys. That's not the idea. It's to protect people, and it's being unfortunately caricatured.
Yeah. Well, I was just playing devil's advocate. I mean,
but that's actually out there. People actually would say that's the problem. And I think, Justin, you know more about it. I don't remember the actual legislation. That was probably the spirit of it. Oh, let's let everyone get the same benefits that
they don't let anybody just pick up and start driving a giant piece of heavy machinery without training and a license.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, you have to show you know what you're doing to be able to rent certain types of equipment or whatever.
That's exactly the healthy analogy for what that framework used to be for. Mm-hmm.
But the democratization is here to stay, whether we like it or not. We can say it's bad or it's good, but
I think it's good. It's
that's
within
true.
A framework. I think it's good in some degree, but, you know, again, as decentralization happens, and in a future episode we will talk about cryptocurrency and stuff, as decentralization of money happens, people are taking much different risks. Whether it's bigger or not is immaterial. It's different. And that's where the markets are going.
You're normally the one who whistles the podcast dead, Eric. I'm just mindful that you're probably going to whistle it dead soon. I would love to get back with Justin and you and talk about some of these trends. I mean, as Justin says, it just is what it is. This Cathie Woods and, you know, the democratization of finance. The central banks across the OECD have been pumping out money. There's a lot of cash flowing around, inflating assets. I, you know, when, Eric, you decide that we've come to our logical progression, we can start talking about some of these macro trends. They're fascinating. I would love to talk to Justin and you about them later.
Yeah, I think we'll do that in a future episode. Are there any closing remarks that you have, Justin?
Just that I'm grateful for the the chance, the invitation, and it's been fun. I would be very happy to participate again should that be of interest. And I think if you started this as a way to talk about the basics of finance, it's such a fascinating world and it's changing so fast that you're not going to run out of topics, that's for sure.
Oh, no, definitely not. And this, I'm learning a lot from doing this. The main reason I'm doing it is to learn. And I'm learning a lot about it. And you guys are on the opposite side of the financial, as Chris would say, you're at the opposite end of the value chain.
Yeah, but we're learning too. We're constantly learning ourselves.
That's how you survive. Creating the stuff that eventually I get to buy 20 steps later. And that's really cool because I never knew where these things actually originated from. I'm used to dealing with people who want to do retirement planning and tell you where to put your money, but they have nothing to do with actually creating those funds. So I learned a lot in this episode. This has been episode 6 of the Recovering Investment Banker podcast. I'm Eric. We've been privileged to have Justin Simpson on here and, of course, Chris Kaufman, the actual Recovering Investment Banker. Until next time, I don't know what we're going to talk about next, but I feel like there's a lot of different directions we could go from this. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.